Welcome to the Rights Track Podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about the human rights challenges facing us today. I'm Todd Landman. In today's episode, we're asking, who are we talking about when we fight for human rights? And are there reasons to be joyful about human rights? My guest today is Professor William Paul Simmons, who is Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies and Honors Interdisciplinary Faculty at the University of Arizona. He's author of Human Rights and the Marginalized Other with Cambridge University Press, editor of Binational Human Rights, the U.S.-Mexico Experience, editor of Human Rights in Our Time, Multidisciplinary Perspectives, and he has a new book coming out on joyful human rights with the University of Pennsylvania Press. So welcome, Bill. It's great to have you on this episode of The Rights Track. You and I have spent time in the U.S. together. We spent time in China together, and I believe we spent time in Oslo together. But today we're on different sides of the Atlantic, but you're always very welcome here on The Rights Track. So I want to start by asking you, Bill, about this notion of the marginalized other. This sounds like a painfully academic turn of phrase. So maybe you could just clarify, what does that mean, the marginalized other? And in practical terms, what does this mean when we're talking about human rights in the world today?
Well, the marginalized other, there's a kind of a philosophical meaning to it based upon the philosophies of the other that dominated French thought last 20 years or so. But more on the practical side, the marginalized other is someone who has been branded as inferior and isn't listened to in society. I use the term cauterization, which has kind of three meanings. Somebody is branded as other, as inferior, as rightless, somebody who's sealed off from rights protection, and somebody who we learn not to care so much about so that we deaden our feelings towards that person. And you can kind of apply that typology to a lot of human rights abuses around the globe through history.
So this notion of cauterization, I mean, it's a medical term, which means you kind of burn off the end of something to seal it. So you're using that metaphorically to refer to the ways in which particular groups are sealed off from access, if you will, to larger society, or at least discursively, they're constructed as someone who doesn't have the same status or access to things. Is that the notion that you have developed there?
Yeah, exactly. And the original meaning of the term goes back to branding. We brand cattle with a cauter. Also, over time, the people have been branded, physically branded. Slaves were branded in the Atlantic Passage. In Britain, felons were branded with an F and other examples as well. But metaphorically, it also happens, right? I mean, we see that with various genocides where Tutsis are branded as beneath human and other groups branded as inferior. When their rights are violated, people don't seem to care as much. We see that with migrants here in the United States and elsewhere. Once they're branded as illegal, then a good chunk of society doesn't care what happens to them and what conditions they live in. And so human rights abuses happen when people have become cauterized like this.
So this is a really timely topic, particularly not only what's happening in the United States, but certainly what's happening in Europe. We've had an incredible flow of refugees from conflict Middle East, particularly Syria. But we've also had other people on the move. And sort of conjoined with this idea of cauterization and the marginalized other, we also see what the discourse analysts call a kind of logic of agreement, where difference is almost erased between groups. So, you know, all migrants became bad in this new discursive sort of construction. You know, so the difference between an illegal migrant, an asylum seeker, a refugee, a normal economic migrant, someone who has absolute right of passage within the EU, for example, we're all lumped together. And you know, some of the most salient version of this was a poster released by the United Kingdom Independence Party, and it had a picture of Nigel Farage, their leader, standing in front of this giant poster of people on the move, and the simple headline was "Britain's at breaking point," and everyone could make whatever associations they wanted to. And this was in the lead up to the European referendum, so it was a really clear example. But maybe even taking your notion of cauterization further by trying to group so many people under the same brand, if you will, that was it, and it proved very effective actually.
And I study this in the U.S.-Mexico border context as well. And I've studied various human rights abuses that migrants have faced, including sexual violence that female and child migrants have endured. And when Border Patrol or Immigration and Customs Enforcement stops or apprehends women and children, they don't ask what kind of suffering they've undergone. They don't probe to find out if they are eligible for various kinds of asylum. And if they are found to have suffered sexual violence, they are still seen as illegals. And so they are still deported as soon as possible. And when this comes out in the media, we often hear people say, well, that's what you get. You deserve that because you cross the border illegally. And so not only do we group everyone, we disregard their suffering as well. Not even taking time to consider asylum claims. If you're illegal, you need to be deported as quickly as possible. And so similar dynamics playing out across the globe, actually.
And this has been raised to high relief in some of the discourse in the U.S. presidential campaigns. Certainly, the original claim of, 11 million people will be deported, and then, well, actually, we need to look at who's going to be deported. Well, actually, and suddenly you find this kind of, new categorization. So everyone got lumped together, and then, of course, the real practical implications of trying to do that started to dawn on people, and then a change in discourse around, well, actually, some can stay, etc., or a ban on all Muslims. Well, actually, the mayor of London's okay, he can come in, and you hear those things here. People talk about immigration, and I say, well, I'm an immigrant, and they say, yeah, but you're okay. There's a lot of coded language in what someone has just said to me, about me being an immigrant here in the UK, and having been a son of an immigrant in the U.S., like most of us, right? So it's a very interesting thing. So how does one challenge the marginalized other? So in what way can a human rights scholar or someone concerned over this issue start to unpack that and start to say, well, actually, your branding is inappropriate or doesn't work or leads to really crazy policy implications or real harm to people? How does one challenge the use of the language and the use of people who are trying to marginalize others?
A lot of my theoretical research is on how to make cracks in hegemonic discourses, right? These discourses that just become so predominant and are accepted without thinking, right? And without critically analyzing our own discourses. And so how do we push back on that? And then let me add one point, too, that this kind of marginalization, this cauterization also happens among human rights folks, right? And that's one of the more interesting pieces. I mean, it's easy to see with the Donald Trumps and the Le Pens and people like that. But it also happens when human rights people brand somebody as a victim or they brand somebody as a sex worker and then don't listen to their voices. And so I'm real curious as to, how do we not only break the hegemonic discourse in the public sphere, but also among human rights workers and among policy folks? And so in the book, the Cambridge book on the marginalized other, I was very interested in playing with the idea of the voice of the other, that we need to patiently listen to the voice of the other. And a lot of my practical work is about human rights testimony and how can we connect human rights folks from around the globe to listen to voices that they haven't listened to previously, or to have solidarity between voices that aren't normally heard together. So I think that's huge. I go from being optimistic that if I can present the voices of marginalized folks, that people will see them as human and deserving of rights, to times where I think this anti-immigrant discourse or anti-Muslim discourse is so overwhelming that these efforts aren't going to make a dent. And so, how do we crack a hegemonic discourse? In my latest theoretical work, I'm talking a lot about the need to do this over time, that this isn't a one-time event, that we need to constantly be presenting the voices of the other. We need to constantly be challenging the system. And maybe there's some room for optimism there.
So this is really interesting. I want to unpack a little bit of what you just said there. It's a real challenge to the human rights community who has a kind of myopia about the goodness of what it's doing and often isn't reflective enough about its own discourses and language. So this idea that someone is a victim of a human rights abuse, and therefore we suddenly know what that means and understand them and don't need to give them voice. There's a kind of dismissal, if you will, because we already know what that means, right? And I think you're challenging that really nicely. So let me push you a bit and ask you perhaps to comment on the Black Lives Matter phenomenon in the U.S., because we've had some events here in the U.K. There was an airport that was prohibited from flying airplanes only a while ago from a Black Lives Matter protest. But I'm curious that is a marginalized other speaking up for itself in a particular way and trying to construct an argument around the disproportionality of treatment towards African Americans, for example. But it's hitting in certain contexts, it's not hitting in other contexts. And there's been a big misunderstanding about it, saying, oh, well, all lives matter, right? And that isn't really the argument they're trying to make. That of course, all lives matter, but they're trying to make the point that it would appear that African-American lives matter less currently in terms of behavior of state officials, police officials, et cetera. So could you comment on that observation a bit?
And as I hear you talk, I mean, it's gotten me thinking a little bit more about this. And the French philosopher Rancière talks about subjectification, right? The standing up for oneself and claiming that I am a man, right? The placards we saw in the civil rights movement in the United States. And that ability to stand up and to make a claim on society, right, is what human rights is about. And I think that when we talk about the backlash against Black Lives Matters or the backlash against the American Civil Rights Movement, I mean, I think that maybe instead of, and again, maybe this is just me being optimistic real quickly here, but I wonder if we didn't get that backlash, that we're not really challenging the system. In other words, that if we don't get a backlash, we're not doing our job. And so maybe we can read that all lives matter or blue lives matter, that the police lives matter, is something that we are touching a nerve, and that maybe that does present an opportunity for discourse. I mean, it's clearly an attempt by the anti-progressive forces to shut down the dialogue, right, and to spell any claim that the rightless are making. But in a way, it is showing that it is making an impact, right? That there is, maybe that's when there's the most potential for change, is when the backlash happens. But then again, you know, I can think of so many other instances where that no change happens after that. So, I mean, when we talk about breaking down hegemonic discourses, I mean, it's kind of a fool's errand. It's kind of a Sisyphean task, right? So it's not something that is going to be done overnight. It's not something that is going to be done with one movement or one moment. So, it's going to take years, but maybe we're on the right track when we do get that backlash.
Well, that's fascinating, and that it raises this idea that in the absence of a dialectic, you don't get change, right? So there has to be force and counterforce, right? Thesis and antithesis, and then you get some sort of resolution. And I don't want to invoke Marx here, but it does sound really interesting about that dynamic interaction between opposing views. And I want to move a little bit into this notion of joyfulness, because I've always thought when working on human rights and particularly when trying to develop new educational programs or new research projects, the ways in which we frame human rights is often quite woeful. And the ways in which, you know, covers of books and posters and campaigns from Amnesty International and, it's always the barbed wire around the candle, or it's pictures of suffering people, or it's babies with distended bellies in Africa, you know, those sorts of things. And yet I also read about compassion fatigue. There's only so much the general public can take. And if you're trying to instill political change, or you're trying to build charity funds or fundraising or bring about some sort of successful campaign, maybe the woeful imagery and the woeful discourses are not the best way around that. But I think your notion of joyfulness goes a bit deeper, and you're really trying to pin down a set of things that I don't think has been done before and hasn't really been discussed before. So could you tell us a little bit about the new project and what's going to happen and appear in the new book?
It kind of started with the same thoughts that you're having, that when we teach about human rights, we don't really teach about human rights. We teach about human rights abuses. And maybe that's a stereotype, but I did a content analysis of syllabi from courses, English language courses on human rights from numerous countries. And terms like abuse and violation and genocide and torture and violence, they appear over and over and over. But words like joy and love and happiness and success and victory almost never occur. And I got onto this idea when I was thinking about my students. I was former director of a master's program in social justice and human rights at Arizona State University. And my students, I came to worry about because they dwelt so much in sad and the tragic and the macabre that it's just not good for your personal health. It's not good for your emotional life. And so I started thinking, you know, is there another way? And then I reflected on the human rights work I've done around the globe and all the people who are supposedly victims and have suffered incredible horrors and trauma. But they're actually usually very happy people, or they've found happiness, or they found joy. And I thought about the human rights victories that don't get put into human rights textbooks usually, right? I mean, we talk about Rwanda in April 1994 as the start of that genocide. We almost never talk about April 1994 being when South Africa voted for the first time after apartheid, right? And the just incredible joy, that inconceivable joy of standing in line, people being able to vote for the first time. And I thought maybe we're only telling half the story. And as you know, there's some human rights scholars who are now talking about the end of human rights and that maybe the human rights discourse has passed. And I think maybe we've only tapped into half of what human rights is about. I think human rights is also about victory. It's also about recovery. It's also about happiness. And we see it in the social movement literature. We talk about successes and we talk about happiness and happy crowds, things like that. But we don't talk about it in some other contexts. And I think we should. And I think we're doing a disservice to our students and also a disservice to the human rights experience if we don't bring in the joy as well.
So one of the common themes that ran across our podcast this season was remarkable, and it was unplanned actually across the podcast, but there was a remarkable understanding that the world is actually much better at protecting human rights than it was in the past, that there's greater awareness about human rights. And even if you take into account that greater awareness and that sort of raise the standard of accountability, I think Chris Ferris called it, and then you would maybe naturally condemn countries even more because you know more about human rights. Even after controlling for that, he shows that global trends over the last 30 years have still been positive for human rights, that public opinion and perceptions about human rights across many different national contexts, the work that James Ron's been doing and is going to publish in 2017 showed that people were actually quite positive about human rights. They understood what they were. They were very supportive of them, and they didn't naturally associate them with, you know, these are rights that protect terrorists and criminals. There was actually less support for that idea than you know, these were freedoms that all people should enjoy, etc. So it's very interesting. I like this idea that maybe we've only been telling half the story. Stephen Hopgood had this book about the end times of human rights, in which he was very disparaging about the sacred language of human rights, etc. And then we were building temples in Geneva and New York. He was actually, his whole critique of the architecture of human rights, etc. And yet you're coming here and saying, well, actually, you know, go talk to the people. Just because someone has had this past traumatic experience doesn't mean they're condemned to a life of misery. It's just part of their life story, and part of their life story is also very happy. You know, people are complex individuals, and you're really getting at the heart of that complexity, I think.
Yeah, and it's been a very interesting project because, let me start with this, that nobody's really written about it, right? I mean, there's been some stuff written on joyful social movements and in the aftermath of Occupy Wall Street and others. You know, there is some literature on that, but otherwise, there's not much on joy and human rights. And I actually do Google searches, and, you know, there's only like 15 hits on joyful human rights. But if you look on of genocide and human rights, you get millions of hits. You know, joy of torture, you get hundreds of thousands of hits. And it's just odd that we are missing half this picture. And then when we change that discourse and we bring joy in, it kind of opened up a whole new world for me. A new way of looking at human rights, a new way of looking at human rights practitioners. And to give you an idea, I mean, we mentioned about the cauterization of victims. As you know, I've done some research on the femicides in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. And I had the wonderful opportunity 10 years ago to hang out after a party with some of the family, the victims' family members. And these women, you know, are amazing, resilient women, but they are brought up on stage around the globe to talk about their daughters' deaths, right? And everybody expects them to be tragic figures. And, you know, the event is a success if people are moved to act and if they cry afterwards. And I was hanging out after a party with them in a backyard, and we told jokes over and over and over, and it was hysterical. And I got to see them as full human beings. And when we see them as just victims, we're reducing them just like the state or like the paramilitary forces want to do. They want to reduce them to victims. And yet these women, you know, they lead full lives. They've had to go on with their lives. They've had to run their businesses. They've had to raise their other kids. I mean, they've experienced something very tragic, but they are full human beings. And to see them as any less, to reduce them. And if we see them as victims, we paternalistically try to provide succor, right? We try to provide them resources that they are in need of our aid. And yet I think we're just as much in need of their wisdom and their knowledge and their experience. And so when we see somebody as a victim, we don't try to learn from them, or we try to provide for them. And I think that changes that whole discourse about human rights victims.
Yeah, and just for folks not, you know, fully aware of that particular circumstance, that was over 300 women murdered. I may even have that number a bit too low. And in many cases, never found, and certainly no justice, in the sense the perpetrators haven't been found and brought to justice. And so they do live in a state of existence where there's no closure for those events in any kind of legal, you know, formal way. But your insight about the second half of the story is around human rights is taking away that extreme focus on victimhood and seeing them as whole human beings. And I think that is a great message of hope, actually, in coming out of that event of despair, but certainly out of many others. And I wonder what would you think if your book comes out, people read it, they ingest it, they kind of take on this notion of joyfulness. What are the full implications of that moving forward, Bill? So how would one apply that to people on the move in Europe, for example, or, you know, the marginalized others that we started talking about at the beginning of this episode?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complex question, right? And as one of the first people to write about this, you know, I'm just kind of getting a sense of all the problems and all the different avenues that this can launch. And so, yeah, just another story maybe to affirm the previous point. But a friend of mine is a former political prisoner in Eritrea. And when he was talking to my class via Skype in the spring, he said he wasn't a human rights victim, he wasn't a human rights survivor, but he was a human rights winner. And that by standing up, by being alive, I mean, the government had tried to shut his voice down. They had tried to kill him. He had been tortured and spent a year in solitary confinement, and he escaped. And he now has a wife and a new baby daughter. And he said, I'm a human rights winner. Don't reduce me to victimization or even being a survivor. I'm much more than that. And so I think that as far as the case of the migrants in Europe, I think it helps break open this cauterization process that happens, and that we don't reduce them just to their victimhood or to their migrant status. These are people who are very much like you and I. These are people who very much have same desires, same needs. And instead of victimhood becoming a form of cauterization, we can reverse that by listening to them, by seeing them as full people. I'm not sanguine about you know, the problematics of joyfulness, right? When we ascribe joy to victims, we often can say, well, if there's this narrative of the happy slave from the U.S. slavery time. You know, when you say somebody is happy, that sometimes can also mean that we've done enough for them or they don't need our help. And that's a very complex issue. When we ascribe joy to somebody else, then we risk feeling good conscience that we don't need to do anything. So in the European context, if this catches on and we say these migrants are joyful, I would hate to see, you know, how the right wing would handle that. You know, well, then they don't mind being in these refugee camps, or they don't mind, you know, being away from their homeland, and they don't need social services because they're joyful. So I'm very mindful of that, and I worry how that can play out. But it also points to other complexities. I mean, in the human rights discourse, I have a chapter on joyful perpetrators. You know, we can't write about joy in human rights without realizing that some of the worst human rights abusers have been extremely joyful while they've done this. I think we can't talk about transitional justice without realizing that some folks are really happy during the massacre. And for some, it was the most glorious time of their lives, as they describe it. And so there's a lot of complexities with this concept. So I not only look forward to the publication of this book, but I look forward to other people adding on to this and correcting my many mistakes.
Bill, this is really cutting edge stuff and really stimulating. It recalls a book I read about the intimate history of killing. And the author argued that in interviewing many soldiers from many wars, that she found that there was this transition that took place after the first kill that led to joyfulness from killing, right? And it resonates very much with what you just said there. So we've taken a bit of a journey in this episode. You've taken us from, you know, how we label things, not only in a pejorative way, but possibly a positive way, but then the dangers of that labeling and the precarity of some of those ideas, as well as their vulnerability to being misused. And I think this opens up a whole new, really interesting world of complexity around human rights. So on behalf of the Rights Track, Bill, I wanted to thank you for coming on today and sharing your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you, Todd, and thanks to your crew, and congratulations on this great project.
This episode of The Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. The podcast project is funded by the Nuffield Foundation, and you can find additional information and resources at www.rightstrack.org.